This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Dr. Mads Gilbert talks about treating patients in the largest hospital in the Gaza Strip during the December-January attacks by the Israeli military. Also, boycott, divestment, and sanctions work to dismantle Israeli apartheid in Palestine. We'll hear about how European activists disrupted a major rail contract that would have linked Jerusalem to illegal colonies in the West Bank. And Peruvian police massacre indigenous people protesting the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement in the Amazonian region. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We return to our focus on the situation inside the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip. Upon his return from Gaza, Ahmed Sabah writes today in the Palestine Telegraph, quote, Gaza itself remains frozen in time for nearly 5 months after the ceasefire, aside from a few rare cases in which cinder blocks have been used to fill gaping holes in the sides of buildings. No reconstruction whatsoever has begun. The blockade keeps the necessary building materials out of Gaza, and at Shifa Hospital, the largest in Gaza, we saw state-of-the-art isotope scan and radiotherapy machines in the oncology department that cannot operate because the radioactive material as well as a calibration tool have been refused entry by Israel. A row of dialysis machines sat unused, lacking the required fluids. As medical conditions in Gaza deteriorate due to the siege, many look for medical care abroad. However, the sealed borders prevent them from traveling. Ahmed Sabah writing in today's Palestine Telegraph. Meanwhile, it seems as though Israel may be granting entry of some very lethal radioactive material into Gaza. Lawyers investigating possible war crimes by Israel in the Gaza Strip alleged that the Israeli military used uranium munitions in the December-January attacks. Haitham Mena of the International Coalition for Trying Israeli War Criminals told a news conference in Gaza City today that results from French, Italian, and British laboratories indicated that depleted uranium was found within about 25 samples, including air filters of Palestinian ambulances and fragments of weapons collected from several places inside the Gaza Strip. Joining us in the Flashpoint studio today is a very special guest, Dr. Mads Gilbert. Dr. Gilbert is a Norwegian physician and human rights activist with the Norwegian Aid Committee. He was in Gaza City working at Shifa Hospital during the Israeli attacks, which killed 1,400 Palestinians, hundreds of them children, and wounding nearly 6,000. Dr. Gilbert is here for a lecture here in Berkeley tomorrow at St. Joseph the Worker Church. We'll give you more information on that coming up first. First, Dr. Mads Gilbert, so good to have you with us finally in the Flashpoint studio.
Thank you very much.
So we've spoken to you a few times on the air about what you witnessed during the December-January attacks, those wretched 3 weeks in Gaza. Bring us back there if you can and tell us what you witnessed, who you treated in Shifa Hospital.
I was in Gaza, occupied Palestine, as late as November 2008, and already then I could see how deteriorated and worn down everything was, from schools to hospitals to people, due to the long-lasting blockade and siege starting in the summer of 2006. And I was very worried because my good friends, my Palestinian colleagues, the children I know in Gaza seemed to be very, very tired and very worried about the future. We didn't know what was coming up. Had I known, I would not have gone home. So I think it's important to understand that the starting point, the baseline on December 27th, when the attack started, was very, very in a nadir, in a very low point from a human point of view and also from a mastering point of view. So when they attacked and hit all the police stations and killed 320 people in one, almost one single attack on December 27th, I think it came as a huge shock on top of this extreme exhaustion. What we saw was a people really struggling to survive with a heroism that I've never seen anywhere else, with their backs against the wall, really, and with their own people coming in maimed and killed and dying all the time. Most of the doctors and the nurses and the ambulance people had their own family members coming as patients, and even the doctors came in, both killed and injured, with their wives and their children also killed and injured. So how they managed to to uphold this immense effort to save lives was beyond my comprehension. And I think we need to pay a deep respect to the kind of humanity they have shown in Gaza. I used to say that if you want to learn about human dignity in the world today, you should go to Gaza, because they're really carrying the dignity of the world in a sense that nobody else does. They are never tempted to behave like the animals they are treated like. Even when we came in on New Year's Eve, given the very difficult situation, the lack of food, the lack of security, and the constant worrying about who's coming in next, they received us with a tremendous warmth and hospitality, as Palestinians always do. Even in that situation, they got us clean sheets for the beds and found a secure place in the hospital where we could stay and really cared for us, which really moved me a lot. So that's sort of the overall picture. And then, of course, it was just to take off the jeans and get into the greens and start working. Unfortunately, I know most of the people, at least a lot of them in Shifa, and I worked there as a doctor as late as last March when they attacked Jabalia, the Israelis. So I know the routines and the whereabouts. And it was like a snap to get into it, and it was really needed. Although you have to understand that Gaza has 410 doctors and a staff of almost more than 1,000 health workers, so they could manage without our four hands. Dr. Eric and me, we were just four hands and four eyes. But it seemed like the most important effect of our arrival was that it boosted their fighting spirit. And they said so also, that now we feel encouraged because we've felt completely abandoned by the world, betrayed by the world, lost in the world, forgotten. It seems like Israel can do whatever they want to do with us without anybody reacting. So then it was clinical work, attending to the injured and trying to keep focus.
That's the voice of Dr. Mads Gilbert here with us in the Flashpoint studio today. And given that there was already this complete lack of resources and an extremely low ratio of humanitarian medical supplies, medicine, bandages that before the siege, what was it like as a physician, as an emergency medical doctor, trying to treat people who are coming in with these absolutely horrific wounds, many of which had never been seen in Gaza before, as white phosphorus was being dropped onto the people of Gaza. Talk about what it was like as a physician, coming from your standpoint, trying to treat people in that situation.
Well, first of all, it was impressive to see the level of improvisation, how they had managed to improvise. The typical disaster situation is that you have an unbalance between resources and demands. And the attack on Gaza, the assault on Gaza, was a 100% man-made disaster, which made it even more difficult from an emotional point of view to accept it. Had it been an earthquake, had it been a tsunami, had it been, some natural cause, we might have had another flexibility to accept it, but this was completely avoidable. It was man-made, all of it. The lack of resources was a result of the man-made blockade and the siege, and the injuries were all of them man-made and meticulously planned and executed in the most horrific way. So I think the most important task for me as a doctor was to focus, not to let my anger obstruct my vision, and not to let the anger get away with me, because then the Israelis would win. So I had to look around and look at the colleagues, my friends and brothers, and see how they managed. And they just kept focusing all the time. And war surgery is quite simple. It's to keep the airway open, to stop the bleeding, to do amputations, to open up the abdomen and stop the bleeding and putting some chest tubes. You don't need a wealth of advanced equipment for that. And they had what they needed in that sense. And we had the basic drugs for anesthesia. Nobody was operated without anesthesia, not a single one. But of course, we had to ration with the resources. And and to find new ways. When we didn't have more bandages, we had to use other stuff. One of the most difficult deficiencies was trolleys to transport patients. We had to put them on the floor. We had to carry them by hand. We didn't have cover enough to keep them warm. The windows in the hospital were shattered. It's cold in Gaza in wintertime. It's like 5-6 centigrades. At night, it's really cold with winds from the Mediterranean coming in, and cold trauma victims. They bleed more than warm trauma victims. So it was a cold, dark, hellish situation. All the city around us was dark because of the complete block of electricity and energy for the generators. It was all only Gaza, only Shifa that was lit up like a small star in this darkness. And all the time you heard the drones and the bombs and the artillery from the tanks. And being a Norwegian, Western, well-fed, respected doctor, I had a hard time taking this. How is it to be a Palestinian child in Gaza? To see the neighbor house being bombed, to see the neighbor boy being killed, and maybe even experience that your own family, God forbid, is being killed and maimed, and this constant threat from these devilish airborne machines, which all the time was watching what everybody was doing, ready to attack with no mercy. So in a sense, I think to sum up, as a doctor, as a nurse, as a paramedic, you just have to focus. You just have to keep focus on the one patient you have, or the one duty you have. If you're organizing the OR, you have to do that. If you're having one patient, you have to do, according to your knowledge, what you're going to do, and not get lost.
That's the voice of Dr. Mads Gilbert. Let's talk specifically about the kinds of weapons that were being used. As I mentioned in the introduction, there allegedly depleted uranium was also used, and we're still trying to investigate that and to confirm or deny that. But we do know that phosphorus was used. We do know that dime bombs were used, as well as flechettes and cluster bombs. You had specific experience with dime bombs, and this is a technology that was developed in conjunction with the U.S. Air Force and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory here in our own backyard in the Bay Area. Talk about what a dime bomb is and how it was used in Gaza and what you saw coming into the emergency room.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that, Nora. I'll just like to make one comment on the discussion on the weaponry, because I think we have there has been a tendency to focus a lot on the white phosphorus, which I think is a deviation from the main problem. The main problem is the Israeli occupation. And we have to keep focus on that. All of this was preventable, 100% preventable. Nobody had to get killed. Nobody had to get injured. Nobody had to starve. Nobody had to get anemia. It's all about an illegal occupation of Palestine that has been going on for, say, 40 or, say, 60 years. And if we forget that, and if we get into the details about, you know, what is humanly right speaking allowed to use and not to use, we forget about the big question, which is the occupation? And the most devilish weapon they used, and the most illegal weapon, is actually the siege, the blockade, which is like, I mean, talk about the Warsaw Ghetto or Stalingrad. Nobody in history has gotten away with besieging and starving out the whole civilian population. This is a human atrocity, and it reflects upon the leaders of the nation doing that in their attitude to other human beings, which I think we have to stick to that question. So then to the dime weapons and the phosphorus weapons. We did not see phosphorus burns, but they were in Shifa in the burn unit. We did not see it, and we consistently said that we didn't see it. We only reported what we saw, but they were used in a way which is probably against international law, meaning used in a densely populated area, causing very severe burns, and they should, of course, not be used. The dime weapons, I saw them first time in 2006 during the Operation Summer Rain. I was in Shifa working then, saw some new, very, very vicious amputations with no fragment injury, no metal fragments like shrapnels, which you see from grenades. We started wondering what these injuries were caused by. We heard from Lebanon they used something called dime. Then I saw it again last year when I was in Gaza during the Israeli attack on Jabalia in February, March, causing 120 killed again, a lot of children, that is already forgotten. We saw the same brutal, very high amputations, and we saw people who were virtually cut in two. If they were close enough to the explosion, they were cut in two. And you could see on the walls around the explosion only 10 to 15 meters away, not a single impact, no shrapnels. And then again now in January, we saw a large number of amputations, which were at the level of the thigh, at hip level. We saw children being torn completely apart, and we saw amputations which looked as if somebody with a huge axe had just chopped off the extremities. We had a 17-year-old boy. We had to amputate both legs at hip level and one arm. And the typicality of these injuries is that they are they must have been caused by a tremendous force so as to break off and tear off the bones and the flesh and the muscles. You know, if you take your hands around your thigh, it's quite thick. And the femoral bone is very thick. It's like a thick stick. So to cut it off demands a big energy. Then they had burns all the way up maybe to the umbilicus at the middle of the abdomen. And they had large red areas on the chest and the abdomen being caused by a tremendous pressure wave. But they did not have any metal fragments. So the dime weapon, if that was the cause, is made by a tungsten alloy, wolfram alloy, a heavy metal alloy, which is in a composite casting like a disposable cup of coffee, you know, and it's shot by quite small rockets. It's also called small diameter bomb. And these, the mechanism of the explosion is like almost like a chain reaction. Causes the heavy metal to evaporate, causing a ball of tremendous energy, which will meet a large air resistance, so it will only travel like 5 to 10 meters and dissipate. So it's made, actually, ironically, it's made for targeted killing, what you call to take out people, meaning executing people without law and judgment. But of course, when you fire these devilish weapons in densely populated areas where 50% are children, of course you will cause civilian death, destruction, and havoc. So we think that from what we saw, we could not explain these injuries with anything else but something called dime or small diameter bombs. And of course, the worrisome thing is that laboratory experiments have shown that the residual particles of these bombs cause muscle cancer in 100% of the animals that you eat. If you embed these fragments, these residuals in the animals, you will actually see cancer in 100% of the mice muscle. And these cancers are completely 100% lethal, and they will also cause lung metastasis. So two problems to sum up: amputations and a large number of these amputations dying as a result of the injury, in particular with the children, and then the amputees who survive the injury and may have embedded the radioactive material in their muscles, and they need a follow-up. So really what is needed now is that the international community, hopefully spearheaded by the WHO, the World Health Organization, will conduct prospective studies of all the traumatic amputations in Gaza who survived, and also in Lebanon, to find out. Because neither will the USA nor will Israel disclose what kind of weapons they're using, the technology, the radiation, nothing. So I think it's time that the international community, hopefully led by the United States, maybe Michelle Obama could take a trip to Gaza to see the realities with her own eyes. I have a strong belief in her good heart. And then without any judgment to start with, just do the scientific investigation and find out. If Israel has nothing to hide, fine, then there is nothing to fear. If they have something to hide, we have to apply international pressure to find out. We cannot allow that the people in Gaza, that the Palestinians, are used as guinea pigs for new weapons developed, be it in the United States or in Israel.
Dr. Mads Gilbert here with us in the Flashpoint studio, and we only have about 6 or 7 minutes left, but I wanted to let people know that you will be appearing tomorrow night here in Berkeley from 7 to 10 p.m. at St. Joseph the Worker Social Justice, at St. Joseph the Worker Church at the Social Justice Committee there at 1640 Addison Street, again in Berkeley tomorrow night. And, you know, this idea, this concept of a weapon that keeps on killing. And before you mentioned, the siege is the ultimate weapon, the blockade, the occupation, the colonization, the ongoing ethnic cleansing. Those are these ongoing weapons that continue to kill and disperse and dispossess people in Palestine. And I remember when I was in Gaza last year at exactly this time, I visited Al Auda Hospital in the north. And the pharmacist there showed me the small cache of anesthesia medication that he had left. And this was before the attacks in December. This was during a period of so-called relative calm. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, there was a list of 90 medications that weren't being allowed into Gaza. And at the top of the list were anesthetics. And as an anesthesiologist yourself, what kind of symbol is that? You know, like wanting to make the Palestinians feel literally as much pain as possible. What is it about this blockade and this project of ethnic cleansing and expulsion? What is it that we should be so concerned about at this point, especially coming from this humanitarian perspective?
Well, I think first of all we have to resist the temptation to portray people that we disagree with as others that we can do what we like to do with. And that goes always in all directions. We had a phone call one day from a German journalist from Der Spiegel, which is a well-renowned German magazine. And that was the same day as the Al-Fakura UN school had been bombed close to it. And this journalist called from Israel, of course, because the Western press was denied access. And she asked Dr. Eric, how is the situation in Shifa? And he said, it's terrible. We've got a large number of children dying, dead and injured, and they have bombed the school. So they have to stop this. And she said, yeah, we heard about the bombing close to the Al-Fakura school. And we asked the Israeli spokesperson about this. And she said that there had been some rockets shelled from that area 2 days before. And Eric got very upset and he said, but listen, these rockets are sent off from jeeps that leave the area within 2 minutes. This is a cat and mouse fight. You know that. And she said, yeah, she knew that. But she'd also, and he says, why did they have to attack the school at noon when all the children seeking sanctuary there were playing around the school? And the journalist from Der Spiegel says, yeah, I also asked the Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson about that. And they responded that they were only Hamas children, quote unquote. And then I go back to 1938, when it was enough to put a yellow star on some child, to deny them human rights, to deny them respect, to deny them security, to do whatever you wanted with them, because they were untermensch, or under people, not like us. The same with the gays, with the gypsies, and that was part of the Nazi project. I'm not saying, underline, that Israel is Nazi. I'm not saying that. But this way of portraying the others as jihad, terrorists, Hamas, Palestinians, whatever you want, which is also prevalent in the United States, by the way, is a way of undermining our common humanitarian platform, which is the decency upon which our culture is built, that everyone has human rights, like or dislike, agree or disagree. But at the end of the day, we have to treat each other as humans. If not, we're going back to the dark times when the people in power can do whatever they want with other people. Tear off the arms, punch out the eyes, torture, maim, burn them alive, whatever. And I have this extremely unpleasant feeling that we in some way are rolling history back again. That's why you and me and everybody in the United States and in Europe have to stand up and say, we will not accept this. We want a humanitarian platform. We want human rights, democracy, and we want the same for the Israeli people as well as for the Palestinian people. Neither of these two people benefit from this attack, from this occupation, from these atrocities, from these definition of the Palestinians as somebody else that you can handle as you like. And I think it's time for the United States govern it, and for the president and for Europe and the leaders in Europe to stand up and say, our names in history will be stained by what's happening in occupied Palestine now if we don't clear out these problems and make an end to the occupation and allow the Palestinians to live in peace side by side with the Israeli people. And there are, you know, some very simple fundamental things for Gaza. Open the borders, stop the attacks, allow the press in, allow humanitarian access to Gaza, allow free flow of building material, of window panes and tubes for the water pipes, and more importantly, stop the occupation, respect the 67 borders, dismantle the settlements, have a fair solution to Jerusalem for both people, and let the Palestinian refugees from 1948 return. That's the only solution to all this criminal activity that goes on. And I think the occupation of Palestine is the mother of all wars today. And we could all have so much more peace if only this atrocities could stop and we could have a free Palestine. And we will not yield until that day. And I can assure you that the solidarity movement in Norway, which is 40 years old, we will not rest until we have a free Palestine.
That's a perfect place to leave it. That's the voice of Dr. Mads Gilbert. I want to let people know again that he'll be appearing tomorrow night, Friday, June 12th, from 7 to 10 p.m. at St. Joseph the Worker Church, 1640 Addison Street in Berkeley. And Dr. Mads, it's always a pleasure. And you do such exquisitely needed, necessary work. And I hope, next year in a free Palestine, we can have a cup of coffee.
Bukra al-Quds, as they say in Gaza, tomorrow in Jerusalem. So, inshallah, we will. And I hope that all the good people of the United States, which I respect so much, will join in with the, I would say, the global movement to support Palestine. And that, indirectly, is also to support the Israeli people and the State of Israel, ironically.
Thank you. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And now for some good news. Man News in Palestine reports this week that under pressure from pro-Palestine campaigners in Europe, the French Veolia company is poised to withdraw from the controversial Jerusalem Light Rail project that links the city center to illegal West Bank settlement colonies. Veolia, which was supposed to operate the transport system after its construction, is now abandoning the project and also seeking to sell its 5% stake in the CityPass Light Rail Consortium. The growing movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel hailed the move as a victory. Campaigners in Europe targeted Veolia and another company, Alstom, over their involvement in the project, ultimately causing Veolia to lose $7 billion in contracts in Bordeaux, Stockholm, and West Midlands in England. Dutch activists also convinced a Dutch bank to divest from Veolia. According to Haaretz, Veolia may try to sell its stake in the CityPass consortium to Israel's Eged or Dan bus companies, a deal which could face scrutiny from the country's antitrust authorities. Joining us to talk about the Veolia boycott victory and other important issues regarding the growing and effective boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israeli apartheid in Palestine is Omar Barghouti. Omar is with the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee and is on the founding committee of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Omar, thank you so much for being with us again on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Nora. Glad to be with you.
Let's start by talking about the campaign against Veolia. If you could lay out the contract that was supposed to be implemented in Jerusalem, linking the city and its illegal settlement colonies to other colonies in the occupied West Bank, and tell us how European activists were able to disrupt this illegal project.
Okay, Veolia is a major partner in a consortium called CityPass, which won the contract to run and establish the Jerusalem Light Rail project, which is an Israeli project intended to connect illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory, particularly in occupied East Jerusalem, with the city of Jerusalem. This is illegal because any service rendered to an illegal settlement is illegal de facto, by definition. It entrenches the colonies in occupied Palestinian territory, and therefore it is itself illegal as a rail service to the settlement. So Veolia was involved in this. So was Alstom, another French giant that is involved in this consortium. Early on, AFPS, which is a leading French solidarity group with Palestine, went to court over this. They sued Veolia and Alstom for violation of international law and Palestinian human rights for their involvement in this Jerusalem light rail. And soon after, the PLO joined the lawsuit. And this is ongoing in France right now. It's applying legal pressure against the two French companies. And in parallel with this, civil society has moved in several countries, starting with the Netherlands, where activists and later groups started applying pressure on Dutch banks to divest from Veolia. One such bank did divest as early as 2006 from Veolia, and that was the first achievement by the growing BDS movement in Europe and beyond. The latest was in 2008, last year, end of October, early November, we held what was called the Bilbao Initiative in the Basque city of Bilbao, Spain, where Palestinian as well as European activists and solidarity groups got together to plan implementation of BDS in the European context. One project that was spawned off of this initiative was a Derail Veolia and Alstom project. Derail, obviously connected to the Jerusalem Light Rail project. Since then, activists in several countries and solidarity groups, particularly in Sweden, France, and Britain, managed to play a significant role in denying Veolia major public works contracts. In Sweden, Diakonia, which is associated with the Church of Sweden, raised awareness about Veolia's involvement in this illegal project and applied a lot of political pressure on Swedish officials in Stockholm to the extent that they did not award Veolia the eight-year very lucrative contract for running the Stockholm Underground Metro for 8 years, and that was worth $4.5 billion alone. Veolia had run the metro in Stockholm for 12 years, but lost the renewal for 8 more years. After that, in the West Midlands in Britain, Veolia again lost a huge contract, and then in Bordeaux in France. Now, Veolia's officials, as well as public officials in Stockholm and France, claimed that Veolia's loss was not political, but rather because its bid was not as competitive. So it was a business commercial decision, so to speak. Our reaction to that was either Veolia says that they've lost $7 billion in contracts because of their involvement in the Jerusalem Light Rail and because of public pressure against them, or they have to admit that their management is so bad that it can no longer win a good bid. In either case, they're in trouble. Now Veolia is reportedly withdrawing from the Jerusalem Light Rail. Haaretz was the first to announce this achievement. We are not 100% sure yet that this is happening. We are judging Veolia according to its actions, not only its announcements as reported in the media. We're waiting for official confirmation from Veolia, but we have not received it yet. Although today we heard two contradicting rumors whether Veolia is withdrawing or not. Mm-hmm. But we surely hope they are withdrawing, setting a precedent to other big companies involved in Israel's occupation.
Omar Barghouti, what does this say about the power that everyday people have in effecting some real change on the ground in occupied Palestine?
BDS is a good example of that. Many people thought that Palestinians are so powerless facing the enormous power asymmetry with Israel, and Israel is indeed a nuclear weapons country. It has more than 400 nuclear weapons. It is the strongest army in the entire region and the fourth largest army in the world. So many people felt, how can the Palestinians resist such a hegemonic colonial and apartheid regime? By resorting to boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, we learned from two sources, our own Palestinian civil struggle against 100 years of Zionist settler colonialism, and the South African anti-apartheid experience. From both inspirations, we managed to wage a war against Israel, a nonviolent war at that, where Israel has no advantage. In fact, we do have a huge advantage morally and politically, and Israel has not yet developed an effective weapon to counter BDS around the world. So it's an empowering campaign for average Palestinians. They can find a tool to resist Israel by, and they can influence a campaign that is global and that's effective and that's already showing results. And just to put things in perspective, compared to South Africa, we're going at a much faster rate. The South African anti-apartheid movement first called for boycotts against the apartheid regime there in the 1950s. The first concrete results started coming in the late 70s, early 80s. So it took 25 to 30 years for the South African boycott to start working. In comparison, the Palestinian BDS movement is 5 years old, and we're already seeing enormous results. Major unions all over the world, especially in Western Europe and Canada, are shifting to the BDS strategy against Israel. So we're already seeing major achievements.
That's the voice of Omar Barghouti speaking to us. He is with the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel and also with the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions National Committee. And Omar, we're also going to hear from the Caterpillar Company boycott campaigners in a moment. But before we go to them to get their latest update, tell us about the cultural and academic boycotts against Israeli apartheid. Some people may say that consumer boycotts are just fine. You can target Caterpillar and Motorola and Veolia. But they criticize the global BDS movement for also focusing on cultural and academic institutions. What do you say to that?
Okay, there are many things that can be said, but very briefly. First, the cultural and academic boycott played a key role in the South African anti-apartheid struggle. So people who joined the boycott then and are calling into question that academic and cultural boycott now must answer this double standard charge. Second, the most common charge against the academic and cultural boycott is that it infringes academic freedom and that it discriminates against individual Israeli academics and cultural figures and so on. This is based on two problems. First, the premise is very wrong. The Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel has always been institutional in nature since its inception in 2004. In other words, we're calling for cutting institutional links with Israeli universities and cultural institutions, not with individual Israeli academics or cultural figures. There's a huge difference. And the main difference is not because we think Israeli academics as individuals are necessarily above average in their support of Palestinian rights. They're not. They're as bad as the majority in Israeli society, as racist as the majority in Israeli society, in certain cases even worse. But we are avoiding an individual boycott on principle because it smacks of McCarthyism. We're against political testing. We're against having a political test to decide who's a good Israeli academic and who's a bad academic. Political tests were utilized in the South African boycott, but it was done by the United Nations, and that would be different. It wouldn't be McCarthyist because it wouldn't be according to the whims of a specific group or campaign or individuals. So we're against the political testing. We're against individual boycott on principle and on the ground. We never endorsed boycotting individuals. It's an institutional boycott. The second problem in this issue of infringing academic freedom is I don't want to use the word racist, but I mean it is. It looks at Israeli interests as the only interests to be considered. It talks about Israeli academic freedom as if only Israelis deserve academic freedom. The fact that Israel, its universities, its institutions have been occupying Palestinian territory, denying Palestinians all rights, including academic freedom, does not seem to concern people raising this question of academic freedom. What about Palestinian freedoms, including academic freedom? So in a way, it sounds a bit racist as well to focus solely on Israeli academic freedom, ignoring Palestinian all freedoms, including academic freedom.
And finally, Omar Barghouti, if people are inspired by this grassroots movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, especially after the campaign against Veolia, how can people get involved? What's the next step here?
Well, in the U.S., there are springing BDS committees all over, but some of the most important campaigns is the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. It has adopted BDS unequivocally. And it's been working on the boycott of Motorola because of its involvement with the Israeli army in the communication system, its involvement in the theft of the Palestinian electromagnetic field, and other crimes, as well as Adala New York. Adala New York is involved in the Lev Levayev campaign. Lev Levayev, the large diamond tycoon, is involved in building settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. And Adala New York was a leading group in the world working for a boycott of Lev Levayev until his company ends its complicity in Israeli violations of international law. There's also U.S. ACBI, the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, that just started in California a few months ago, and it's been endorsed by hundreds of academics in the U.S. So far. It's a very promising campaign. It played a major role in the boycott of the Bat Sheva Israeli dance company when it toured North America. It raised a lot of awareness through its very creative and artistic protests against Bat Sheva. But there are so many others. I don't want to leave any group out. There's a BDS group in Boston and Vermont and in so many U.S. cities, a BDS campaign exists now. So students can join many groups. Academics can join the U.S. ACBI. People can find several BDS groups to join. Currently, the Motorola campaign is the biggest campaign in the U.S., and I urge everyone to join that.
Wonderful. And people can go to bdsmovement.net to get linked up with other organizations and to learn more about the power of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israeli apartheid in Palestine. That's the voice of Omar Barghouti. He's with the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee and is on the founding committee of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Omar, thank you so much for all of your work, and we'll keep looking at this Veolia campaign very closely. Thank you.
Thank you, Nora.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. On Friday, Peruvian police forces opened fire on a group of indigenous people in the northern Amazon city of Bagua, killing at least 25 and wounding over 100. Over 600 police attacked the several thousand unarmed indigenous Awajun and Wambis people, including women and children. Members of the tribes had set up a roadblock to protest free trade laws and the ongoing environmental destruction of their land and exploitation of their economy by multinational corporations. Joining us for some background and an update on the current situation is Gregor McLennan of Amazon Watch. He's down there in Bagua, Peru. Gregor, thank you so much for joining us today on Flashpoints.
Hi, yeah, nice to speak to you.
So if you could start by bringing us up to date for people who haven't heard the news over the weekend, tell us what happened on Friday.
What happened on Friday is there is a group of 2,500 indigenous people here on the road between the towns of Jaén and Bawa, who had been protesting for 56 days as part of a nationwide protest by indigenous people all across the Amazon against a series of laws that were passed in the context of the free trade agreement in the United States, which undermine their rights and open up legal holes for land to be passed to corporations, for plantations and forestry concessions, and facilitate mining and petroleum exploitation in the Amazon rainforest. On Friday, the 5th of June, at approximately 6 a.m. in the morning, the police decided to take action in order to remove the protesters, and they did so by first, I think about over 500 police approached the area where they're protesting and started by firing tear gas. the indigenous protesters initially didn't move from where they were. They stood firm, decided that they weren't going to move and they were going to keep the road blocked, at which point testimonies tell that the police just started opening fire straight into the crowd. What followed was basically a bloodbath with many indigenous people being wounded, many being killed. Unfortunately, on the other side as well, police were killed. Some of the indigenous protesters attacked the police as they were shooting at the others. And what followed was a series of running battles back towards the town of Bawa as the indigenous people were throwing stones back at the police, and the police were throwing stones with fire from gunshots and tear gas from helicopters flying overhead, firing live rounds from the helicopters and dropping tear gas on the indigenous people who were running into the hills to try to escape.
And Gregor, today, what has the atmosphere been like after this bloodbath on Friday?
Well, today, I personally haven't left to go and visit the area. Everyone has recommended that I stay indoors for my own safety, given that I'm a foreigner here and the government is currently launching into a discourse about this whole thing is caused by foreigners agitating the indigenous people because they don't want Peru to develop. Meanwhile, the rest of the great team here from the radio stations and the local reporters and the local human rights organizations have been going around and gathering testimonies. And currently, there are over 900 indigenous people in hiding, and various like local people have put them up in their houses because they're terrified of being put into prison by the police and beaten and tortured, and they're wanting to find a way to get back to their lands. Meanwhile, we're slowly starting to get testimonies from indigenous leaders, from local townspeople who saw the attacks to find out what really happened. And bit by bit, lawyers are arriving and the Ombudsman office is arriving to try and figure out how many people were killed, what order the events happened in, and what happened to all the dead indigenous people. Because so far, official figures are still reporting, I think it's 3 or maybe 5 now indigenous people dead. And everyone we've spoken to has talked about numbers much higher than that. I wouldn't be surprised if we find there are 50 or more people dead from the indigenous protesters.
That's the voice of Gregor McLennan of Amazon Watch. He's down in Bawa, Peru, where over the weekend, scores of indigenous members of tribes in the northern Amazon region were massacred by Peruvian police. Gregor, tell us about the context here. People of these Amazon tribes have been resisting for decades against the neoliberal economic exploitation by multinational companies who have swarmed into Peru, in the Amazon region in particular, and the people have been subsequently attacked by the government. Take us through the history, if you can, of indigenous struggles in the Peruvian Amazon against these multinational corporations and against the government and what they're up against.
Well, I mean, the history is long. I mean, we can go back as far as the rubber boom when Europeans were all over the Amazon in the search for rubber when rubber was tapped from trees. And that resulted in thousands of indigenous people being enslaved. It resulted in many deaths, and that kind of sets a context within the history of indigenous people in all areas. Many people after that rejected all contact with the outside world. Everyone became very wary of outsiders and the white man. But ever since then, the Amazon has simply been seen as a resource to be exploited, to get money out of outsiders, see it as just as benefit for them, and they see indigenous people that live there as obstructing that development and getting in their way, and also see them as being unproductive in the way they live. The president of Peru himself has a discourse that he's published in several articles in the newspapers and in his speeches. We call the síndrome de perro del hortelano, which in English we have a similar phrase, which is the syndrome of the dog in the manger. I mean, a dog that is sitting on the hay that won't let the cows come and eat the hay, but doesn't know how to eat the hay itself. And indigenous people, in reaction to that, they feel that they're not being respected, that the government isn't respecting their way of life, and it isn't respecting their right to continue their way of life and participate in decisions about what kind of development they actually want.
And what does this say? Speak a little bit more about the role of the Peruvian government in this post-Fujimori era And as these free trade agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA and other deals continue to plunder South America and Peru in particular, what has the role been of the government in Peru against the indigenous people?
Well, the current government seems, I think, the worst government we've had for a while in terms of respect for indigenous rights here in Peru. They seem to have taken an attitude to really push for massive expansion of industry in the Amazon rainforest. We've seen a huge increase in petroleum lots throughout the Amazon. We're seeing a massive push to encourage private investment in the Amazon. And meanwhile, attempts at every stage to reduce environmental restrictions, to open up land, take away, reduce the rights that indigenous people have, open up there have been lots of new draft laws which attempt to open up the Amazon to private investment and take away land from indigenous people. The government over the last 3 years has attempted and failed to pass several laws through Congress. What happened in the last year, through the process of implementing the free trade agreement, the president was given executive powers to pass laws that didn't have to go through Congress. Now, he passed a total of 99 laws, of which 10 of them affect indigenous land rights and affect the environment in the Amazon. Now, these laws the government is saying are necessary for advancing Peru and implementing the free trade agreement. And they're positioning indigenous people and anybody who's against these laws as being against the development of Peru and being against the free trade agreement. So indigenous people are saying that they do want development. They do want health services for the new diseases that have come from contact with the outside world. They want schools and education for their children. There are some things that people want from the outside world, such as television, such as electrical light, such as radio. It varies from group to group across the Amazon. Everybody is different in their aspirations. But what many people, almost everyone, seems clear about is they want development in a way that doesn't undermine their identity, that they can continue maintaining their identity as indigenous people, and that their environment can continue to survive, to provide food and fish and fresh water for future generations.
And Gregor, what are people most concerned about in the coming days and weeks in the aftermath of the massacre over the weekend? And really, where does this leave the indigenous struggle right now?
Well, I think it's set the whole struggle back by several years, if not decades. It's a tragedy what's happened. I mean, I think everyone is still reeling about what's happened, and everyone is very worried about what else has been happening in more remote areas, such as Pumping Station 6 on the Northern Peruvian Pipeline. We know there were some police killed in a rescue attempt to rescue some of the police that were taken hostage by the indigenous there. We don't know how many indigenous were actually killed in that confrontation or what has been happening. And I think it's going to take a while over the next few days or weeks or maybe even months to find out exactly the true cost of human life that the government's attempt to reopen the roads have really had. Meanwhile, the indigenous leaders across the country, whether it's Northern Area or in Lima, have had charges brought against them. There have been orders out for their arrest by the Minister of Justice and herself, saying that she will not rest until justice is brought to these people and they are put into prison, blaming them for inciting the violence and manipulating the whole issue. So at the moment, the indigenous organizations are sitting without their leaders and no clear people who can help negotiate with the government on their behalf, whether on behalf of the indigenous protesters, who can help try to bring peace back to the situation. So what has been really marked about all the indigenous people I've spoken to who were involved in the protests, you saw their brothers and family and comrades die under police fires. There's no direct anger against the police. There's no feeling for revenge. Simply people are angry about what happened, about the injustice of it, and they're angry about the fact that this hasn't been covered in the media. Like, the real story is not getting out about who was killed and who started it about the fact that the indigenous people themselves were not armed. And they're shocked at the way that this happened, about how they were peacefully standing there and the police started firing on them. And what they're asking for is justice, for an independent investigation into what happened with international observers that they can trust. Because they need to get beyond this. People here are worried about what this will turn into. The Agwahoon and the Wambisa are traditionally warrior and warlike people. But the people I've spoken to now have said, no, that this is in our past. We need to get beyond this. We understand that we mustn't be drawn into a cycle of violence, and we need to sit down with the government and talk, but there needs to be justice. There needs to be fair justice. And that means it's for the indigenous people who did kill police, as well as the police that did kill indigenous people. That's a necessary step. And everyone who was responsible for death has to pay the price. But they want the true story to get out.
And finally, Gregor, you're with Amazon Watch. How can people in this country and across the world, how can people get involved and help?
Well, I think on the Amazon Watch website, we have an action alert to write to the Peruvian government to let the Peruvian government know that the world is watching, the world is horrified at what's happening, and asking them to step down. At the moment, in other areas of Peru, the government is sending more troops in to open up road blockades in other areas. So it's important that the government immediately stops this violence and this tactic of stopping peaceful blockades by sending in fully armed police forces. Also, in the U.S., you can write to Congress and ask the U.S. to make some kind of public statement about what is happening. The Peruvian administration is using the free trade agreement as an excuse for these laws and as a justification in some cases for their actions. And it needs, I think this is not what the free trade agreement was about and the intention of the people in the U.S. administration who implemented it, and they need to make it clear that this is not what the U.S. government wants. This is not the kind of relationship, there's not the kind of country, the not kind of situation that the U.S. wants to be entering into a free trade agreement with.
All right, that's the voice of Gregor McLennan of Amazon Watch. People can go to amazonwatch.org for more information on what's happening in Peru now, and of course the action alert that you just spoke of. And we'll keep a very close eye on this story as it develops. Gregor McLennan, again, please be safe, and thank you so much for being there and for speaking with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.